10 Days in a Madhouse by Nellie Bly. Chapter 7, Inside the Madhouse. As the wagon was rapidly driven through the beautiful lawns up to the asylum, my feelings of satisfaction at having attained the object of my work were greatly dampened by the look of distress on the faces of my companions. Poor women. They had no hopes of a speedy delivery. They were being driven to a prison through no fault of their own, in all probability for life. In comparison, how much easier it would be to walk to the gallows than to this tomb of living horrors. On the wagon sped, and I, as well as my comrades, gave a despairing farewell glance at freedom as we came in sight of the long stone buildings. We passed one low building, and the stench was so horrible that I was compelled to hold my breath, and I mentally decided that it was the kitchen. I afterward found I was correct in my surmise and smiled at the signboard at the end of the walk. Visitors are not allowed on this road. I don't think the sign would be necessary if they once tried the road, especially on a warm day. The wagon stopped, and the nurse and officer in charge told us to get out. The nurse added, "Thank God they came quietly." We obeyed orders to go ahead up a flight of narrow stone steps, which had evidently been built for the accommodation of people who climbed stairs three at a time. I wondered if my companions knew where we were, so I said to Miss Tilly Mayard, "Where are we?" "At the Blackwell's Island Lunatic Asylum," she answered sadly. "Are you crazy?" I asked. "No," she replied, "but as we have been sit here, we will have to be quiet until we find some means of escape. They will be few, though if all the doctors, as Dr. Field, refuse to listen to me or give me a chance to prove my sanity." We were ushered into a narrow vestibule and the door was locked behind us. In spite of the knowledge of my sanity and the assurance that I would be released in a few days, my heart gave a sharp twinge. Pronounced insane by four expert doctors and shut up behind the merciful bolts and bars of a madhouse. Not to be confined alone, but to be a companion day and night of senseless, chattering lunatics, to sleep with them, to eat with them, to be considered one of them, was an uncomfortable position. Timidly, we followed the nurse up the long, uncarpeted hall to a room filled by so-called crazy women. We were told to sit down, and some of the patients kindly made room for us. They looked at us curiously, and one came up to me and asked, "Who sent you here?" "The doctors," I answered. "What for?" she persisted. "Well, they say I'm insane," I admitted. "Insane?" she repeated incredulously. "It cannot be seen in your face." This woman was too clever, I concluded, and was glad to answer the roughly given orders to follow the nurse to see the doctor. This nurse, Miss Group, by the way, had a nice German face, and if I had not detected certain hard lines about the mouth, I might have expected, as did my companions, to receive but kindness from her. She left us in a small waiting room at the end of the hall and left us alone while she went into a small office opening into the sitting or receiving room. "I'd like to go down in the wagon," she said to the invisible party on the inside. "It helps to break up the day." He answered her that the open air improved her looks, and she again appeared before us, all smiles and simpers. "Come here, Tilly Mayard," she said. Miss Mayard obeyed, and I, though I could not see into the office, I could hear her gently but firmly pleading her case. All her remarks were as rational as any I had ever heard, and I thought no good physician could help but be impressed with her story. She told of her recent illness, that she was suffering from nervous debility. She begged that they try all their tests for insanity, if they had any, and give her justice. Poor girl, how my heart ached for her. I determined then and there that I would try but every means to make my mission of benefit to my suffering sisters, that I would show how they were committed without ample trial, without one word of sympathy or encouragement. She was brought back to where we sat. Miss Louise Shans was taken into the presence of Dr. Kinnear, the medical man. "Your name?" he asked loudly. She answered in German, saying she did not speak English nor could she understand it. However, when he said Miss Louise Shans, she said, "Ja, ja." Then he tried other questions, and when he found she could not understand one word of English, he said to Miss Group, "You're German. Speak to her for me." Miss Group proved to be one of those people who are ashamed of their nationality, and she refused, saying she could not understand but few words of her mother tongue. "You know you speak German. Ask this woman what her husband does," and they both laughed as if they were enjoying a joke. "I can't speak but a few words," she protested, but at last she managed to ascertain the occupation of Mr. Shans. "Now what was the use of lying to me?" asked the doctor with a laugh which dispelled the rudeness. "I can't speak any more," she said, and she did not. Thus was Miss Louise Shans consigned to the asylum without a chance of making herself understood. Can such carelessness be excused, I wonder, when it's so easy to get an interpreter? If the confinement was but for a few days, one might question the necessity. But here was a woman taken without her own consent from the free world to an asylum, and there given no chance to prove her sanity. Confined most probably for life behind asylum bars without even being told in her language the why and wherefore. Compare this with a criminal who is given every chance to prove his innocence. Who would not rather be a murderer and take the chance for life than be declared insane without hope of escape? Miss Shans begged in German to know where she was and pleaded for liberty. Her voice broken by sobs, she was led unheard out to us. Miss Fox was then put through this weak, trifling examination and brought from the office convicted. Miss Annie Neville took her turn, and I was again left to the last. I had by this time determined to act as I do when free, except I would refuse to tell who I was or where my home was. This is from Devil in a Blue Dress by Walter Mosley. "Hey, Hattie, looks like you got a boarder out on your doorstep. Drunk old white boy?" "Yep." "I'll have Junior look out there later on. He can sweep him up if he's still there." With that, I put the drunk out of my mind. "Who you got playing tonight?" I asked. "Some of your folks, Easy. Lips and his trio. But we had Holiday Tuesday last." "You did?" "She just come breezing through." Hattie's smile revealed teeth that were like flat gray pebbles. "Must have been about, I don't know, midnight, but the birds was singing with her before we closed for the night." "Oh, man, I'm sorry I missed that," I said. "That'll be 6 bits, baby." "What for?" "John put on a cover. Cost going up, and he trying to keep out the riffraff." "And who's that?" She leaned forward, showing me her watery brown eyes. Hattie was a color of light sand, and I doubt if she ever topped 100 pounds in her 60-some years. "You heard about Howard?" she asked. "What Howard?" "Howard Green, the chauffeur." "No, I haven't seen Howard since last Christmas." "Well, you ain't gonna see him no more, in this world." "What happened?" "He walked out of here about 3 in the morning the night Lady Day was here, and wham!" She slammed her bony fist into an open palm. "Yeah?" "They didn't hardly even leave a face on him. You know I told him that he was a fool to be walking out on holiday, but he didn't care. Said he had business to see too." "Hmm. I told him he hadn't oughta left." "Killed?" "Right out there next to his car. Beat him so bad that his wife Esther said the only way she could identify the body was because of his ring. They must have used a lead pipe. You know he had his nose in somebody's never mind." "Howard liked to play hard," I agreed. I handed her 3/4. "Go right on in, honey," she smiled.